Hi, I'm Frances Katzen, and welcome to my podcast, The World of Real Estate. In this series, we will explore the world's largest asset class and how it plays out on a global scale. Today's guest is a real estate icon. Dottie Herman is one of the most successful women in the history of American real estate, a self-made powerhouse who transformed a leap of faith into legacy that reshaped the entire industry. From her early days on Long Island to leading the acquisition of Douglas Elliman and scaling it into New York's largest brokerage, Dottie has consistently defied expectations and rewritten the playbook for what leadership and mentorship looks like. Under her tenure as CEO, Elliman grew into a national force with a global alliance spanning 60 countries. Her name has graced Forbes, Crain's, The Observer, Power 100, and countless lists honoring her vision, influence, and grit. She's also my friend. She's also the longtime host of Eye on Real Estate, a radio show that has helped demystify the market for everyday listeners, proving that no matter how high she rises, she never loses touch with the people at the heart of the business. We're honored to sit down with you today, Dottie, to talk about legacy, leadership, and the evolving world of luxury real estate, and to hear, in your words, what it takes to build an empire from the ground up.
First, let me just say this, Fran. I love you, and as far as people in the company, you're one of the most disciplined, top-class people who is a master and a perfectionist in this business. And this business has a lot of people, but not a lot of great people, and I consider her great, but I also consider her a friend. And you just made me turn red.
Because it's all
what
true.
I did, Fran, what I do is what I love, you know, and I always tell people, if you're a ballerina before that, if you're not passionate about that, you can't be great. So I was always passionate about building this company. And I always say I was really lucky to have people around me that helped. We built it together. I don't think alone I could have done it.
Yeah, but you cultivated that. So we're going to start at the top. We're getting ahead. You've been called the quintessential New York success story. What do you think gave you the courage to borrow millions to buy your first brokerage with no money down when others might have walked away? That always blew me away. Talk about moxie.
I think I was young, you know, and I remember because the company was for sale, and I think I was about 29 years old, Fran, and so I loved running. I think I was running a region, and I loved it. And I said, oh, I'm going to lose my job. I love this job. And then some person who was probably my age said, well, why don't you buy it? And I said, because I have no money. And they said, well, just say that you do. And I don't think I would do that today. But at 29 years old, I said, all right, that's a good idea. And so some of the husbands of some of the women that worked with me came in and we wrote this whole business plan and this letter to Prudential saying that I had venture capital people who wanted to invest in the company and that I'd like to be considered to buy the company. And, of course, I didn't. I had gone to banks, and they had said to me, we wouldn't even lend you the money for one off, let alone a company.
So didn't they ask for a proof of funds?
Yeah. To make a long story short, a year later, they got to me because they had to sell the whole United States. And after some, you know, talk, and I believe relationships are always so important, so I've always kept a good relationship with them, then I had to tell them the truth. I said, why don't you lend me the money?
Wow.
And they said, we can't. And of course, I know you know that no doesn't always mean no. It just might be no today, but tomorrow I might change my mind or whatever. I learned that in sales. So finally, I convinced them to let me to sell it to me. And I didn't have any money to put down, and I certainly couldn't guarantee it. I had nothing to guarantee it with.
That's insane.
Yeah. But that's what you are when you're 29. You're not really afraid of anything.
Oh, my God. It's like Barbara Corcoran. The two of you were like leaders. Wow. You've spoken about losing your mother at a young age and how that shaped your drive. How did that early loss influence you in the leadership style and resilience in this business or in business in general?
Yeah, I often think about that, Fran. I think, what would I be like if my mom had been alive? Because I lost her when I was 10 and I was the oldest of, I had a younger brother and sister. So I kind of had to do everything.
Wow, Dottie.
I you know, you never know for certain, but I don't know that I'd be the same person. I think I would have had a very traditional, I think I would have, you know, gone to school, graduated and married somebody, which I did, and just have a family. And I think I would have been a teacher, which is what I think I wanted to do then.
And really?
I don't think I would have ended up, I mean, the business kind of, you know, really, it's in my heart, it was in my soul, and I just loved it. And so I would have been good, but I don't think I would. And not having a mom, I had no one to ask. You know, when can I go out? I could go out anytime I wanted. I could stay out. I had no, my father was in another world because he was injured from the car accident. So I think
who looked
that
after
growing
you?
Up with no one and having to make all my own decisions and doing anything I pleased from when I was 10 years old on, I think that's kind of what really helped me a lot in life, even though you wouldn't think that, but I think it did.
I left home at 15 and grew myself up, so I can't imagine at 10 what that must have been like.
Well, it's hard, and it's hard even at 15. But I don't think you really think about it.
No, you don't. You just get on with it, right?
Yeah. You just have to go on with your life, and you just do it.
But who looked after you? Was there any type of family around? Nothing.
No, but we lived, you know, and when I grew up, it was a time where, you know, a lot of the women did not work. Yeah. And so, you know, and people were friendly. You know, you knew all your neighbors. We would at night play kickball, you know, do stuff like that. So I could go to my neighbors at 12 midnight and say, oh, I'm knocking on your door. And they'd get out of bed and I'd say, oh, my boyfriend broke up with me. And I was crying. They'd say, all right, come in. You know, when I needed to set my hair or do something, they always helped me. I had, you know, and these are people that did what they did for myself and my brother and sister, not for money, not for fame, just because they were good people. And
makes
I never forgot that or them. And I try to be the same.
Yes, you do. When you and Howard Lorber acquired Douglas Elliman in 2003, it was already a story brand. Mm. How did you approach modernizing it without losing its legacy?
Oh, yeah, I thought it needed a facelift. Let's put it that way. I said, you're right. It's a legend. It was the first real estate company to really make the profession. There was no profession of real estate at one time. I did work very hard. I hired a company that works with positioning your, you know, what you want people to see. And it was an interesting exercise. They showed me different objects and what do you want people to feel when they hear Douglas Elliman? What do you want them to think? What do you want them to feel when they see the name? And then there are certain colors and things that are associated with that. And then I went back to the original logo from the 1920, whatever it was. Okay. And I took that and I gave it to them. And I said, take this original logo and just modernize it a bit.
And you did.
Yeah.
It was the coolest brokerage on the block.
Yeah, I think so.
You took it all the way. I'll never forget it. Because I was at the Corcoran. And I left the day Barbara Corcoran sold the company in 2006.
Well, a lot of people left then. And that shows you, and I don't know how many people realize what's the importance of having a leader like Barbara, who was a family and made everybody a family. And people cried when she left. They couldn't go to another company because she had a non-compete, so they couldn't follow her. But I know some of them, and, you know, they still love her. You know, they always loved her because she really did care about them.
But then you and Howard were we called it the mom and pop. You held the company. It was never Sendant or a third party. It was you guys.
No, that made all the difference.
Yes.
That was the beauty of Douglas Elliman. He did not, even Corcoran, they had to abide by Sendant. I think it was Sendant then. We were our own company, so we didn't have to abide by anything other than the law. I would just tell people, you can do whatever, try new things. We're going to experiment because you always want to be innovative. But I don't like wide stripes. They make me look fat, so I don't want to end up in jail.
I love that. So under your leadership, Elliman then became the largest residential brokerage in New York and one of the top in the United States. What was the pivotal decisions or cultural shifts that made that possible? Because I remember going from sort of this sort of blended brand to suddenly cutting edge.
I think a couple of things. I think, first of all, when I first started, all that anybody talked about at the meetings was Corcoran, Corcoran, Corcoran. And it's not that I had anything against them. I said, I don't really want to hear about them. This is Douglas Elliman, and we're just going to concentrate on Douglas Elliman. And then I said to everybody, I don't like average. I'm not someone that can say, you know, oh, I'll just do it and, you know, whatever, and I'll be at. If I'm not going to the top, I can be bad and getting better, okay? But I can never say, like, that's why I don't play golf. Because I can never say, well, I'm not a great golfer, so, you know, who cares? I'll just play. So I said, I don't like average. And then I made everyone in the company, which I knew that they probably all didn't read it, so I made cliff notes, read from good to great. And it was about companies, and they had to have a history of it for over 5 or 6 years, what the difference between good and great was, and what made a great company. And I told everybody, good is the enemy of great. Because most people are okay with good.
Good enough.
I'm not.
I know.
And then we worked as a team. You know, everybody, no matter what your job was, if you put listings into the computer, we needed those people. So I made everyone important.
Yes, you did.
Everybody is important, no matter what their job is.
But you showed up and meant it. You had a culture. You would sit with us once a month at a table and talk about the market.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter who we were. You knew who we were.
Oh, I did. But I loved you guys, and I couldn't have done it without you. I really couldn't have.
I think we
it was, we built a family. We built a culture, you know?
Yes.
And then when we started expanding, and then we got friendly with the people in Florida. I mean, it just, it was a place that, you know, you really didn't want to ever leave. We would be there at night till 9, sometimes 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Yes.
And I was talking to Ken Haber, the attorney that was the attorney that still does work for Douglas Elliman. He stayed at my house for a couple of days with his wife. And he said, Donnie, do you remember? We used to be there at 10 o'clock every night. I said, I remember. But it wasn't like a job. It was more work. We wanted to be there.
Yeah. You made it really fun. You've been named one of Forbes' richest self-made women in real estate and one of Crain's 50 most powerful women in New York. How do you define power, and how has your definition evolved over time?
That's a good question. So I don't look at myself as power. I tell people I have grown, but I'm still the same person inside that I was 25 years ago. And I never let anything go to my head.
No, so you never did.
You know, and I never will, and I never did. And, you know, there's that song, I think it's Sinatra, Flying High in April, Shot Down in May. Okay. You know, so I never did it. I never walked around. I remember people to get into restaurants would say, well, say who you are. And I'd say, no. So they would call and get in themselves and say they were me. I never used that. I was me. And
yes, you were.
I don't want people to follow me or do anything because of power or they're afraid. I think that people have to want to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, look, Fran, I know you, and you are not someone that follows unless you really believe it.
Yeah. That is real leadership, by the way.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know, maybe you know the answer. I never figured it out because people would always ask, can you build a leader? Can you make someone a leader if they're not? Or is it a natural ability that they're just born with and then you hone in on making them better? I don't really know the answer. But I do know, because you asked me about my mom, since she died when I was so young, I think, you know, I was the oldest. I had to lead. I had to make decisions, and I didn't have anybody really to ask. So I think that also helped me become the leader that I.
It's scary, right?
Yeah, there were times that, you know, look, there are times that I didn't know if I was going to be able to pay the, I would say, don't cash the checks. Okay. I don't know if I'm going to make the payroll. Yeah, but I was always honest with everybody. You see, with you and everyone, there was no pretense. It wasn't kind of like this authority. It was, everybody knew everything. And there was no real secrets.
Yeah, you're right.
And I think that people, first of all, feel comfortable that way because they know that somebody's not going to come out of the clear blue and just do something that's going to screw their, you know, what they're doing up. But I also think that it was total honesty. Like the good, the bad, and the, you know, there were times, there was a time, I don't know if you remember, I think it was 2008 or something, maybe before that, the market was bad.
Yes.
And I said to everyone, look, I could either let go people because I'm going to have to do that, or we could all take a pay cut. And starting with myself, and then all the people, like I had like numbers, like, you know, if you made, the more people made, the more I took. And then if you made less than a certain amount, I didn't take anything. I said, but you vote. You know, I asked all the agents, what do you want to, all the people that worked, all the employees, what would you like me to do? And they said, don't fire anybody. We'll take the pay cut.
Wow.
And we all did, you know, from Ken Haber to myself, everybody, all the executive, we all did. We got through it. And actually, when it was all said and done, we ended up paying off our loan.
Your radio show, Eye on Real Estate, has been a trusted voice for years. What inspired you to start it, and how has it helped you stay connected to buyers, sellers, and agents?
It's a funny story. I was that naive. I was on Joan. That was a Joan. I can't think of her name, but she used to like tell you where to get tickets, where to buy things cheap. You know, she was on the radio for years. And I was on her show. And I was on a couple of radio shows, and they said to me, oh, Donnie, you know, our boss thinks you were really good. He wants to have dinner. He thinks you were great. So I'm going there thinking he thinks I'm great and all this. And he's like, you should be on radio. You are great. And I'm like, oh, really? Thank you. Blah, 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 blah. To make a long story short, I tell him, I don't have time. I'm running a company. I have no time to do a radio show. On and on and on. He said, look. So finally, because I think he lost somebody, I said, look, I will do it till Memorial Day. And then that's it. I have a house in the Hamptons, and I want to spend my weekends there. Okay. So I said, I do it. I did it till then. And then I realized, and then all of a sudden, I got a bill. And I think, what is this? And it was a bill for the radio.
No.
And I called up. This is how naive I was. I said, I just got a bill in the mail. And he said, oh, that's because, you know, if you have the radio show, you have to pay for it. And I said,
what?
Well, they're not going to pay for it. I said, I knew Howard. There's no way he's going to pay for my radio show. So I made a deal with the station, and I said to them, I'll tell you what, on all your shows where they're, you know, where they're hosts are on like 5 days a week, they go out and they get sponsors. I said, if you get sponsors and sell my show, because you have a staff doing that all day anyway, you can keep half of the profits and the rest will pay for my show. And that's what we did. And then I started doing it. And believe me, it's every weekend I write my own show, but I actually enjoy it. Or I wouldn't do it.
you enjoy because it gives you an outlet to just touch in. Yeah.
Yes. And I started a second show on Sundays, Fran, called Real Talk. And that has nothing to do with real estate. But I think that people are afraid to really say how they feel.
Yep.
And I, you know, one of the things I think I loved about our relationship, you know, and things like that, is that we were always real.
Yes.
You know, we didn't have to be afraid, oh, if I say this, she might not like me anymore, or she might think differently of me. And I just think that's so difficult because, you know, we respect differences. We don't all have to agree. So I started a show on, you'll have to come on it, on Sundays for Real Talk, which has nothing to do with real estate. Just
I love it.
Real subjects and people really talking about what it was really like. And
that's all beautiful.
You look at yourself. Everyone looks at you and God, between ballet and a top person in the entire industry in the United States, they don't stop and think about, you know, how many hours, the days, the things when all your deals are falling apart at one time.
Yes.
I mean, they don't see that.
No.
They see a beautiful woman. Okay. They don't see you balancing kids.
Totally.
I mean, it's really, and so I think, but I think that anyone who's great at something, unless you won the lottery or unless you are a parent, you can get money from the bank of mom and dad. You really have to work hard to get anywhere, and you're going to slip and fall.
I mean, all the time.
It's part of it. And you have to be, I have a thing in my office that says success is failure turned inside out. And if you are afraid to fail, you'll never succeed.
I think you are so right. It has probably been one of the most amazing odysseys of my life, but excuse me, it has also been one of the most complicated and demanding and rewarding and truly gratifying experiences. I feel incredibly grateful for everything that I've gone through and have. And I mean it. I'm not just saying it.
I know that. And boy, you balance a lot.
So do you. You've interviewed countless experts and insiders. What's the conversation that changed your perspective or surprised you?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know if it was one conversation. I think that what influenced me greatly was my time with Merrill Lynch. And it was in the days that Merrill Lynch was Merrill Lynch. And everything that they did was either top of the line or they didn't do it. They had a thing that the people are the assets of the company. So they invested a lot of money in their people. And, you know, in
how so?
Yes, because their motto was the people are our assets.
Wow.
And when you think about it, of course you want customers, but if you don't have good people, you're not going to have customers.
Right.
So I they were very big on training and offering all these different courses, and they sent me all over the country. And I learned like that, just because New York doesn't do this doesn't mean that California's not doing it. And actually, the Northeast is much slower to change than the East, than the West Coast.
Really?
So a lot of times, yeah. So a lot of times what they're doing, we didn't even get to yet.
How did you get into Merrill and being taken seriously, given the fact that most women were getting married? And there you were, rocking and rolling the way you do.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of how I even got. Oh, I know. I was young and I had a little girl. And so my husband at the time was a real estate. He's a certiorari attorney, which is taxes, real estate taxes. And he said, you should go into real estate. I was teaching. And he said, oh, you should. And I did. And, you know, I wasn't that serious about it. Then I went back to school to get certified in financial planning because that's what I thought I was going to do because I decided teaching didn't make enough money. And my boss that I worked – so when I finished my certification, I went to my boss that I worked part-time in real estate, and I said, listen, I'm leaving. I told you. Now I have my Series 7. I'm going. I'm leaving. And he said, oh, don't leave. And I said, why? He said, because I am selling my company to Merrill Lynch. And with your background, financial background, and you know, I had a Series 7, you really could be a home run. You should meet them. And then I found out where the head of the real estate was. I took a plane. I went to his office. I did not have an appointment. And you could be a highest ranking person at Merrill. You didn't break it. You didn't go have an appointment with the chairman or the CEO. So I just did. I went in the office and the woman said, do you have an appointment? And I said, no. She goes, well, you can't be here then. He has, you know, you have to have an appointment. And when she went to the ladies' room, I just walked in. And the guy was stunned. And then I said to him, but I read in a book that if you want to get somewhere in life, you have to go where the people who make the decisions are.
Wow.
I said, and so that's you. And I came here and I saved up my money and I would be great.
Wow.
And he just started laughing. And that really was the start of it. I don't know if I would do that now, but.
Why not?
You know, I think people are afraid of the word no. You know,
yes.
But, you know, what is somebody going to say? Or if you say, I'm going to do this and it doesn't work out, then they say, oh, the people are going to look at me like a loser. I really think that people get crazy. What's the worst that can happen?
Well, so, I think resilience has changed, right? The idea of resilience.
Yes. But you know, especially, and you know, in real estate and certainly in ballet, if you don't have resilience, I don't know if you should even bother.
100%.
Okay, and with real estate the same way. I mean, you know, if you don't have resilience, and you know, I remember in the beginning when I first started and I was first like managing and running offices, and then people would line up to speak with me, and oh, my husband, he's cheating on me, so I didn't. That's why I had a bad month. I wasn't paying attention. My child did this, whatever, and I would say, oh, okay, you know, don't worry, you'll do better next month. And then I realized. You know, I have issues. I have things that are personal, but I still come to work every day. And I realized I wasn't helping them. I wasn't helping them by letting them be a victim.
So how'd you change it?
I said, you can come and ask me a question. If you first write the question down and then put whatever you think is the right answer. Okay. Even if it's wrong. But if you don't write it down, you can't talk to me. So half of them never came because they didn't want to write it down.
Wow.
They didn't want to be bothered to write it even down.
Wow.
And then the ones that came and had an answer, their answer was right. Okay, usually for most part. It's just that it's easier if somebody says, oh, yeah, fine. I can go to Zadie. She'll give me the answer. And my job really is to grow people. You know, I mean, I think that's really important, growing people. And so by giving them the answers and not letting them think and not, you know, and now look, some are never going to do that because there are people who are just going to be followers. But I hope that, you know, I would help people get to where they wanted to go and push them like I was pushed. I was pushed, you know, one day I said to my boss at Merrill, like, if you're not happy with this, I did so well. He said, Daddy, I always told you I'm going to push you. And push you and push you. And I didn't want to let him down. So I think that's pushing people and not letting them make excuses. Obviously, if you're, you know, deathly ill or something like that. But, you know, I always tell them when it's bad, just wipe yourself off, take a couple of days, cry a little, and then get back in the game.
100%. So interesting hearing you speak at this point in my life. It's amazing. You often spoke about New York global appeal, both as a lifestyle capital and an investment haven. The city has hit some headwinds in the media with negative press in the headlines. What's your current outlook on the city's luxury market as we look at what's playing out?
Well, let's put it this way. I tell everyone, don't ever bet against New York. Okay? In the worst of its times, I said you're going to lose. However, I never do anything political on my show. Ever. I did it for the first time in my life. And I said, I never talk politics. I don't want to lose half my audience. I'm not dumb. I said, but I said, I have to. And I just talked about I just said, if this guy gets in,
I know,
he's a socialist.
I know.
And you might think it's great because it's, and I worry with people that are young because it's free this, free that, free that. So if you're young, maybe you say, wow, look, everything's free. And I don't really want to work that hard anyway. I was in Cuba when Obama was in office. There was a period of time that we were able to, you can't go to Cuba now, but you were able to go. And I was there for maybe 2 weeks with my friends. And they will tell you they're not socialists and they're not communists, but they are.
100%.
And the government has to know everything you do. We couldn't even have dinner without, you know, we had to have an agenda, like this is where we're eating dinner. This is where we're having lunch. This is the time. They have nothing.
I know.
They have nothing. And you, in the parks, there's beautiful parks all locked up. And you can see the grandeur. And I don't want to really get on the story, but I had a driver because you can't even rent a car there. And the kid was about 22 years old. And he said to me, do you want to hear music? And I said, sure. And he said, you know, you want to hear the Beatles? I said, sure. And so he puts on She Loves Me. And then he puts on like the Rolling Stones, Ruby Tuesday, which are really old. He was only 22. I don't think he was born when they were on. So I said, where did you get this music from? And it was the same story. He said to me, when I was born, Castro would come into office. And he banned all music from out of the country. We only could listen to the Cuban national anthem.
Wow.
My parents, who were probably about my age, this is the music they grew up with, and they hid it.
Oh my gosh.
This is the only music I've ever heard, the music my parents grew up with that they hid and saved.
My gosh.
He had a little tattoo of the Beatles, like one of their first albums. And that was sad. There was no music allowed. It's complete poverty. And if you talk to anybody who fled, there are a lot of people in Florida are there because they fled Cuba. If you talk to anyone who lives in a socialist country, just ask them what it's like. And I think that's what I think it is.
Well, it goes against the constitution of what New York is built
and
America's
and so
built.
If he gets in, I don't know how much, and I'm not really read up on this 100%. I don't know how much power he can have by himself.
Correct. But it does hurt what is the build up and makeup of this town.
It does. And you have people, you know, when someone said, oh, they're bluffing, you know, you have people look. In New York City, I don't know, I think it's kind of 8 or 9% of the people pay the majority of taxes. I mean, the majority of taxes are just paid by a small percentage of the very wealthy people.
Correct.
So if he wants to do more to them, then look, there's a lot of, New York is a highly taxed state. And then there's the mansion tax and this tax and that tax. So now he wants, I think, add 2% flat tax. If you would tax them to the point that they leave,
they're gone.
Then he won't have any taxes because the rest of the people don't pay taxes.
Correct.
It's mostly this small percentage of people. So if he did his homework, he would know that if they flee, and they will, if it gets too crazy, then he'll have nothing. So, you know, I think he's already charged. I think he united people against him, but I think he's already trying to change his stance a little because he's changed his stance on cutting the police department. I just don't know. I just feel that if I shouldn't give my political thoughts, but I will. I just think that the other candidates have to do the right thing for New York City. And two of them have to drop out.
Well, they won't. That's the problem, right?
Okay. That's what I said. Because that's how he's going to win.
I know.
Okay. I thought that Andrew Cuomo said, or maybe he changed it, but I know in the beginning he said that if he's not in the lead, he won't. He'll drop out. I know that nobody else said it. Okay. So, okay, I know that... Curtis said it. No, I don't think anybody else said it, but we'll see. I don't know, but I you know, let's say you know, you live in New York. We are so resilient.
This
and
is next
I just
level.
Hope people have the fight in them to fight for, like, you know, when everybody gave up on New York, we had the pandemic, we had so many things,
yep.
The World Trade Center.
Yep.
So now no one's going to live here anymore. No one's going to buy a high rise.
I know.
No one's going to live downtown anymore.
I remember that one.
Remember?
It went on to rally at the highest numbers and exceeding uptown. I was like, yeah, baby.
Right. And then all of a sudden, the downtown became greater than ever. The higher the floor, the more you had to pay.
Correct.
And downtown really revived itself into way better than it ever was. So, and that was pretty tough. So I think we're resilient. I just hope the younger people are as resilient as we were, because we all fought for New York City, because I think if you're a New Yorker, there is really no other place like New York City. It, first of all, is the most visited place. It is, and I do this on my radio show, it's the number one place that people want to go to. You know, all the young kids, that's where all my friends that live out of state, I say, I'll be the New York mother, because they all their kids want to go to school in the city, and they want to be in the city, and they love New York City. And, you know, when you go, look, I'm in Florida a lot, and it's a great state, and the weather's good, but everyone's
just... It ain't New York.
You grow so much in New York, don't
yes.
you think? Because it's 100%. A melting pot of every religion, every culture, every race, and every language. And guess what? We make it work. Nobody cares what you dress like, what you talk like, what country you came from. If New York is accepting of everyone.
Correct. That is true.
Yeah. And don't you think you grow by working with, you know, when you look, I came from Long Island, and basically the suburbs, you know, these people live in this area. If you have a certain income, maybe you live in this area. New York is all mixed up, and I think that I grew tremendously from moving into the city. I know I did.
Just did you ever feel sort of like, I'm not a city woman, when you would stand up?
Well,
was it hard?
At first I did. When I first started working in the city, then I said, I can't commute, I'm taking an apartment, and I have to be part of New York City to be the CEO. I would say, listen, I can't do this. I'd be downtown. I said, I need green. I have to see some green. Okay, where is there a beach? I love the ocean.
Me too.
But now, I wouldn't leave the city. Now, I'm lucky that I have the best of both, because I have a house in the Hamptons, so I can get that. But I don't think I would ever leave the city. I mean, I think that... I don't want to say never, because never is a word you should never use. But I just think that it offers, it's so diverse. There's no other city like it. Now, I would love to get people together to try to really get people to really rally, like we all did always, to make it a better place than ever.
I know.
It's gotten some bad publicity, but still people want to be there. And Fran, you know, I think there's a lot of uncertainties now in the world. A lot of uncertainties, and I think people,
yes,
I think it's even affected the real estate market, because I think
yes.
that it's slowed down. And I think, and I know, because I do my homework because of the show, that there's so many not baby boomers, millennials that haven't bought houses because they were either priced out, there was an affordability factor, or there was no inventory. So, or some are waiting for interest rates. I think there's so many buyers out there that have not bought. They've been on the sidelines. And you find that when there's a lot of uncertainties, which right now we're living in a world with a lot of uncertainties, I think some people just take a back seat and say, let me just wait. And
correct.
My advice to them on my radio show is, don't wait.
Don't wait. You don't want to be buying at the top. Go
right.
against
I said,
the grain.
What's going to happen? They'll lower interest rates and there'll be 30 million people coming
That's
out.
Right.
And you'll have so much competition, you'll be
That's
paying more.
Exactly what I say.
Right?
Yes. So you've supported organizations like the American Heart Association, the Tillis Women's Health. You've been actively involved in initiatives like Every Woman Matters Walk. How has philanthropy, shaped the way you think about impact and leadership beyond the business world?
Well, it's probably part of who I am. I mean, I I think every business should really, you know, really donate and be involved with charities. But, you know, sometimes the people at the top are involved and sometimes they're not.
Yeah.
You could give to everywhere. Every day some organization calls me, so you can't give to everything. But listen, I am very involved because it's important to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a stent when I was 39 years old. And nobody even knew that, and nor would they think that. But I mean, and I'll never forget. I was 39 years old, and nobody gets stents at 39. And
that's so young. I didn't know.
In my main artery, I had a 99.5% block, and I had just come to the city, and it had just happened. And I said to my doctor, "I'm just doing the city now. Do you think?" He said, "Do you love what you do?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, then do it, because if you don't do it, you'll be sick." And then I went to Dr. Oz, because somebody in Douglas Elliman, because I didn't know doctors in the city, said, "Oh, go to Dr. Oz." He wasn't famous then.
Wow.
You know, nobody knew who he was.
What did he tell you?
I went to his office. He was not famous. He wasn't on TV
yep.
or anything. And he said to me, "Oh, you're like all these women." He goes, "Look at breast cancer. No one knew about it. Then we made everyone aware. And now everyone goes to mammographies, and, you know, they have really come a long way with helping women with breast cancer. It's not fatal as it used to be." But there was awareness. And heart disease was like a man's disease. They didn't look at a woman getting it, and a woman doesn't have the same symptoms. So I teamed up with Dr. Oz. Now, again, he was not famous. And we went around, and we talked about heart disease. And I have to tell you, I did make a difference, because people looked at me. Now, I was probably like 30, no, I don't know, I was young. And they said, nobody thought to give me a stress test. And if I would have had a stress test, I would have known. So we made people aware.
Wow.
And then I brought these little kids on that I, you know, that were like 10 years old and 7 that had heart disease. So, and I did go around with Dr. Oz for a while with heart disease. And I was very involved with it. In New York City and also in the Hamptons.
My gosh, I had no idea.
Yeah, wow. because women aren't aware and they don't have the same symptoms. That, you know, I didn't have any symptoms. So, and then when they would look at me and they realize, well, wait a second, this could happen to me. And so that awareness is really important. And I hopefully, and even in my career, if I can help anybody or save anybody from having to go learn the lessons that way, then I would. And I think that it's really about awareness. And if you know, breast cancer is so down because people are aware, women are aware, and so they most go for their mammographies or their, and so now heart disease is the same way.
I had no idea. Wow.
I think it's the number 2 or 3 killer of women.
What?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, because you don't think of it that way. You think of it as a man's disease.
Yes. Is it can it be brought on by the stress itself, or is it just?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't really know if they know. I mean, they can say it could be your genes. You could have had, you know, like my grandparents, they were. Most of the grandfathers were dead. So I didn't, when I was born, I don't know what they died of. They could have died of heart disease. Because I remember them asking me, is it in your family? And for anybody that was alive, it wasn't. But I don't know beyond that. And it could be caused by, you know, I think stress can add to it. But I had a block in my arteries. They were blocked. So it wasn't that my heart was damaged. But if your arteries get blocked, then the blood can't get through, and then you die.
Yeah, no, my father
had
it. Yeah.
You know, I always go for a stress test, and I am very, and I try to tell people, because if you go for your doctor's exam once a year, they don't give a woman a stress test. They give you whatever your insurance pays for, which is usually an ear test, you know, your heart, whatever. You won't know if you have blocked arteries if you don't have a stress test.
Wow.
So I will tell people, you know, you don't have to do it every year, but every couple of years after 40 years old, you really should have a stress test, because that will show a block. There's nothing wrong with my heart. My heart is very healthy. but it was a block in my arteries.
Wow. You're a partner in Lady Sheila Stable 2, an all-woman's thoroughbred syndicate. What drew you to horse racing, and how does that world mirror the high-stakes nature of real estate?
Well, actually, nothing drew me to it but friends. Okay. It wasn't something I was thinking, oh, I can't wait to do this. But I, you know, I 24/7, you know this, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But, you know, I had a family, I was in real estate. It was 24/7. Everyone I knew was in real estate. And somebody once said to me, God, every time we see you, we're always with real estate people. So I now was in the city and I decided I couldn't commute anymore. So I took an apartment and I decided I have to make friends, you know, that are not in real estate also. And I think Jill Zarin, maybe it was, said to me, you know, we're putting a group together and we're going to be all, we're all women, we're all around the same age, and we are going to pool our money, and well, everybody has to give $100,000, and we're going to buy racehorses. Well, we're going to, now I didn't know anything really about racehorses, but they, when the younger you buy them, the cheaper they are.
Got it.
Because you don't know if they're going to have good genes or bad genes, really.
Mm-hmm.
So they would buy them when they were young, and they would be like $30,000. And now we had 15 or 16 of us. And so we bought all these horses. And we would go to all the, we'd go to Saratoga. And this is all, they were all really, for the most part, good-looking girls. And we would get dressed. We would go to Belmont, and we'd always be dressed. And people would look at us like, why are you dressed? One guy said, maybe dangerous. And we had a ball. We really did. We traveled together. We, matter of fact, I went to Cuba with those girls. We really had a nice time. And but one by one, the horse, you know, horses are an expensive thing to have. You, we had like 17 or 18 of them. And I think I have a piece of one now.
Wow. That's how?
Yeah. But because, I mean, I loved it when I did it. But you really have to be willing to, if you're going to really get into the racing business, you know, a little neck, the horse just can't run. He has a temper that he doesn't like to be pushed. He can't run. There's so many things.
Just so, like brokerage.
Yeah, there's so many things. So I don't plan to get into golf, but I have other hobbies that I like to do better. But I stay with them, and I still go to Saratoga and stuff like that. But most of us all dropped out after that. As the horses, one by one, we lost them somehow. And we then donate them to schools where they teach kids how to ride.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's really nice. What's your advice to women who want to lead in male-dominated industries, not just to succeed, but to own the table?
I think if that's what you're passionate about and that's really what your vision is and that's what you love and if it's a male-dominated industry, I think you have to go for it. You have to be willing to go for it. You have to be willing. I mean, there's still, I don't think it's as bad, but there's still a difference between how men think and women think.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You can check the public companies. Most of the money they give is from not women companies.
I know.
It's really, it's that. Come a long way. I don't want to say it hasn't, but it's not,
but it's
even
still,
close.
No.
So I think some, you have to do it, but you have to, you know what you're getting into. But I don't know if you're a person with my personality or, and you really want to do something, then you're not going to be happy doing some job that's 9 to 5 that someone tells you what to do.
No, I agree.
Okay. You're going to be like yourself, an entrepreneur, and you're going to want to. But and look, that's not easy. And I don't fault anybody. You know, some people need to feel better that they get this paycheck every day. I do a lot on my show on Sunday, which is why I want you to come on, because you were a big career change of people that somewhere in their life, they had a great career, but then they decided, you know what? I love this career, but now I have to, I'm ready for something else. And they made a change. In somewhere in their life and went to a completely different career and became successful at it. But they talk about what it took to do that.
Oh, boy. Yeah. That was for the record books. What is the most important lesson you've learned about building a life, not just a business, in this industry?
Well, I don't know if I'm the right person to ask, because I would have to tell you, I have to make my life is, you know I would probably say I failed. You know, I went to all those courses on balance. You know, time management. And then, you know, you don't take the phone call when you get home. And I had a boss, not that, that when I was at Merrill, it was like that. He said, like, I'm going to teach you that you don't answer the... I failed. You know, when I'm immersed in something, I think you have to make it work.
Yeah.
I kind of had a, you know, like you have kids, you have to know when your kids need it a little bit more than you. You have to sometimes, you know, you kind of like pushed and pulled, and, you know, you kind of have to figure it out. And you have to have a supportive family. But I remember, Fran, when I would call up my daughter's friends' mothers and say, oh, thank you so much for picking them up. Okay. You know, they knew I worked. And I usually did the night shift of picking them up. But they said, oh, no, Dottie, you should see how the girls talk about you and how they look up to you having a career. And so, you know, I don't think it's a bad role model. I think it's just tough balancing it all. And you're like a juggler.
Always.
And then sometimes you have to say, what about me? You know,
trust me. You don't have any time for yourself. It's really hard. And the guilt. I'm always feeling guilty.
Oh, I know that.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Yeah. But you know something? They'll be better for it.
Why do you say that? That's so interesting.
Because I looked at my daughter and I looked at all her friends and their mothers didn't work. And when she was little, they said, oh, does your mother even love you? She goes to work.
Wow.
They all ended up like looking up to me. I think it's a different time now. I think that, you know, when I was young, a lot of people didn't work. I think that just economically people have to work sometimes. I think that it's, you know what? When my daughter was little, I went to a pediatrician and I said to him, I just got divorced. I've worked 24/7. I said, and I don't spend as much time as I'd like to. I try to balance it, but it's impossible. And he looked at me and he said, both parents were doctors. They dropped me off on a Monday. They picked me up on a Friday. He said, it's not how much time you spend with your children. It's what you give them in the time that you spend with them.
Quality.
And then he said, there are parents and mothers that are home all day. And they're frustrated. They're like bored. They don't want to be there. And they're not happy. And he said, when you're happy and when you're doing things that you love, what happens? That happiness flows to the people around you.
Yeah.
When you're miserable, the same thing happens.
Yes.
So, you know, it was what I did. And I don't think it's a bad example. He said it's what you give them in the time that you're with them.
Yeah, 100%. It's the quality, not the quantity, 100%. I always get the judgy moms looking at me like, mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm like, thank you.
I do too. But I'm telling you, that's what my pediatrician said. And I have a great relationship with my daughter. And, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. We had our fights. Girls are tough. But we have a great relationship, and she's very independent. Like, yeah. I've always taught her, and I'm sure you'll teach her. Like, you know, marriage is great, but you have to have a career, and you want to be in a marriage because you choose to be there.
That's exactly right. Not because you can't leave it.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that, to me, is very important, that all women have something that they do, that they can do, that they don't. That they're getting married if that's what they want to do, because they want to do it, not because they need an income.
Marriage is beautiful, but it's really important that you hold on to yourself in the marriage and keep that identity and independence,
yes.
I think. It makes it more interesting for your partner, by the way.
I think so, too.
I hear it all the time. My clients are like, listen, I wish my wife worked, because sometimes I feel like I don't have a lot to converse with.
Well,
and
right,
thought,
because
wow.
They're home all day with the kids, and then the husband comes home, he's tired, and then... You really can talk about the kids all day. And
that's right.
So when I was really young, I was in my 20s. I think I was doing a part-time job at like a Record World or something like that. And there was this young guy, and we thought he was a nerd. He goes, I just got married and we have date night. And we said date night, and we were laughing in his face. Now that I think about it, oh, well, he maybe had the right idea.
He did.
I mean, where, and they say that now. It.
Yeah.
Where even if you have to get out of the house, that you pick a night, that once a week, you at least get out of the house with your husband or your significant other and just do things that you like to do.
Well, 100%. Wish I'd known that then. looking back, what would you tell your younger self walking into that first Merrill Lynch office in the late 70s?
Make it till you make it.
My words exactly, Dottie. Fake until you make it.
I'm being honest. Okay. Yeah. That's what I think. I think you have to look the part. You have to dress successfully because the first thing if they don't know you, they're going to look at how you look.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I always tell people then try to figure out who are the decision makers and make sure you get to know them. And then give. Like I was very involved with Merrill and Prudential in other things that they did that had nothing to do with Douglas Elliman, that, you know, I started their fine homes program because Merrill had a fine homes name. Like, you know, Merrill was fine. You know, Prudential was a big company, but it wasn't known in the higher ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I helped take all their franchises and we built the fine homes division. I did it for free and helped all the franchises so that we could have a high-end thing. I think that you just have to be part of something and give back. And I think the way things work best are when people are teams and you have all different talents because everybody's good at something different. And
you were
at the
good
end
at
of the
bringing
day,
people that out. You were good at bringing that out of people. Sorry for cutting you off, but that was a skill you had. You brought out the best in people.
Brand, you know what I found? And I don't know if it's just me, but I've said this to people. I found that we built a team. And if you remember, everybody had their own goals, but then we had a company goal that we were all part of. I think people will work harder to not let their team down than they will sometimes for themselves.
Wow.
Because if you don't want to, you know, if you feel, oh, you know what? I'm tired this week. I don't feel like making, you know, worrying about making a sale or getting a listing of it. And that's just you and you have no one to work. Fine. But when you're in a team and everybody has to produce and you have to make numbers and you're the only one that doesn't and you let everyone down, that's really hard. So I think people work better. They'll work harder. They don't want to let their team down.
You just said it so well. Really crystallized that. What are the latest projects you're working on and what's in the pipeline and for you?
Well, I'm working on, I can't say the hotel. I'm helping somebody who's looking to buy three hotels that actually is in the middle of negotiating three hotels in New York City.
Wow.
You know, I do some on the side consulting work. I ran a company. I don't need to do that anymore, but I feel I have a lot of knowledge. And of course, I think the biggest thing is to be successful is to know what you don't know. So I know what I know, but I know all the people to go to for things that I'm not like that I know, but I'm not like an expert in. Oh. And I just finished a book, but I have to have it kind of looked at. I mean, I'm not a great writer. I just finished a book and, you know, I'm doing a little consulting and I really have told you that I have really taken some time to have a life, I don't want to say I didn't have a life, but, you know, I don't have to tell you, I have a family and this and that. 24/7. So I never really had time for that. I didn't miss it. It's just your life is whatever your life is. But now, you know, I have friends that are now my age, you know, a little younger, mostly younger, but a lot of them never work. Some work. Some of them now retired. Some of them still work. But I feel blessed. I have a lot of good friends. I know a lot of people and I love people. So I'm always learning and I think it's, I think it's been a good year. I think this is a chapter that, you know, I hope to leave some legacy and I hope to make a difference because I think at the end of the day, you really can't take money with you unless there's a world that I don't know of. I think that, and I tell my daughter this because she's a teacher and she teaches like in a not great section. New York, and she could leave, but she won't. She said, these kids need me.
Wow.
And I tell her, you know, if you can make a difference in just a couple of kids' lives, maybe we can't change the world, but if you can make a difference in a couple of people's lives, then I think your life is a success.
100%. Congratulations, Mama. You just created the change maker. It's those that make the change too, big time.
Yes.
You know, that's the real.
Fran, I have this feeling, and I know we haven't spoke for a bit, but I'm sitting and like, I know. I just feel it in my gut, and I'm saying this out of, you know, no plan. I just feel it in my gut. We're going to end up doing something together. I just know that. I just feel it in my bones.
I'm in. I'm telling you, you have no idea. It has been, I've been wanting to do this for so long with you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just have to say this. I'm not, but you are a very special and unique person. And the discipline and the perfection and the just everything about you, I respect, I love you. And I think you are so talented. And I know how, when you do something, you either do it all the way, the right way, or you don't bother. And let's face it, in any industry, there's not that many people like that. So I think that we should get together right after we, you know, Memorial Day, or maybe you'll come to my party, I'll send you an invite. And then we really should just go and have some dinner. I miss you.
Yeah, me too. I have so many questions. Now I'm at this point in my life, so many questions. What's your secret? What's your secret sauce?
There is none. I don't have a secret sauce. I do. When I say read, I don't have the patience to read through whole books anymore. But I subscribe to this business book summary where they summarize every book.
It's I love that. I want that.
Okay. So you can sound like, you know, you know that book. Like, it sounds like I read every book, but it's really not. It's all the best business books, and they just make the cliff notes at.
I call that ChatGPT these days.
Oh.
Just because I am a working mom, and I'm like, three lines or less, surmise this document, this book.
Listen, but I'm gonna it's going to change our lives. I can't even imagine how much. I mean, I know in California, like, imagine your children, they'll be driving to school by themselves.
I can't cope with that one. I know. That's just bonkers to me.
Yeah, I know, but they're doing that in California already. So, and I said, well, I would be a wreck. But it's really going to change the world. I can't even fathom how much I think the world is going to change. I think it's kind of like an industrial revolution, maybe 100%. Even bigger.
But I don't think we recognize that we're also playing with a very dangerous paradigm to this. And unless we harness it, it can get really crazy really quickly. I'm very
uncomfortable. Do you know they can mimic your voice?
I know.
And then they could call somebody and say, this is Fran.
Yes, they've been doing it. Yes, it's frightening.
The whole thing is frightening, but I don't think you're going to stop. I don't think you're going to stop it. I think what you said is the best alternative is that we have to hone it in.
Yes.
But I don't know if that's going to, I don't feel that's going to happen because I feel there's always people out there that want to really say, you know, I don't want to be in this box that I'm only allowed to be in. And right now I think on the news today, they said that there was a child that went on chat, one of the AI things. I don't know which one it was. And I guess, I don't know how they know if it's a child or not, but I guess he said something about love, and the AI gave him this detailed thing that you would give to an adult.
Oh, boy.
And the company apologized for it and said it was their error. I don't know, there's some way they should have known it was a child, or there's something that, you know, but I think it could be very dangerous, but I don't know how they'll stop it, because I think there's always going to be people out there that want to push it.
100%.
And I can't even imagine, like, I'm not frightened about when they say it's going to take jobs, because people, I think companies, if they know they're going to be taking these employees out of jobs soon, then they should train them for the jobs that they need.
Well said.
I think that everybody should be like, I go online. I took a course on AI.
Did you really?
Like a basic course, just because
you're
I feel
so cool. Who does that?
Well, because I don't want to be left out in the world.
But that
says
everything.
I don't want to be of a certain age that I don't even know what the hell's going on anymore.
But that says everything. I mean, it's so funny. There's this advert on YouTube, or commercial, I should say, where they say, are you one of those people that doesn't realize that you could build an entire company through AI? Do you still think it's just for ChatGPT? And I'm like, P.S., that would be me. Okay. And you're telling me that you took ownership and went online and did a course on AI. Like,
yes.
Whoa.
Yes. And talking about that, I was having dinner this week, last week, whatever. And this guy that I know, who is a billionaire, he might be 40 or 45 with that.
Must be nice.
And he kind of was in charge. He did the whole thing with crypto. He's a genius. He said to me, Dottie, I just built a whole system for real estate with only AI. He said, I want you to look at it. And he gave me a number, which I haven't done yet, but I just saw him last week. I think you're going to see a lot of changes.
Yeah.
I think that the whole world is going to change. And I think that we're all going to just adopt to it. But I do think that in real estate, you know, I think you could have AI would know the history of houses and apartments better than anybody else could remember them. But I still think that the human touch is really important. And they haven't perfected AI to the point where
they will never be able to.
It doesn't have feelings.
It also doesn't know what it doesn't know. There are latent defects that will never be put in writing, whether it's radon gas or whether it's the minutes that were not put into that file. Forget about it. If you are buying an illiquid asset, there is no way in hell you are going to part with it unless you have one human being who can give you the nod and say, no, you're good. There's always going to be a checkpoint, I think. You don't part with money just with AI. Sorry.
Oh, no, I don't think so. I mean, I can't speak for 50 years from now, but I see in my future, I don't see anybody. I mean, I see it as a great resource.
Yeah.
I think in the medical profession, they're using that, but they're not getting rid of doctors.
Okay. Correct. There's still got to be a human element to it.
Yeah. So I think it will change a lot of things that we do. And I think that, for example, I mean, I can see having a person that's AI be the receptionist and say, well, she'll always be nice.
She'll always be on time.
Yeah, she'll always be on time. But I think, no, look, I'm not looking to get a job in AI, and I'm certainly not looking to be an expert. But I don't, you know, as you get older, you don't want to end up not being in this world.
Right.
You know, like my dad used to always say, oh, in my day. And I'd say, Dad, but it's not your day.
Yeah, we're past that day.
Yeah, we're past that day. So I think it's good for people to keep up.
My kids are still saying, Mom, on concepts.
How
I'm
old
like,
are they
oh
now?
My God. What?
How old are they now?
12 going on 25 and 6 going on 80. They're like old souls. What would you say is the biggest achievement or win in your career?
Oh, Douglas Elliman. When I was able to, because that wasn't for sale.
Yeah.
That was a cold call. I said, Howard, all the customers in the Hamptons are from New York City, and we don't have offices in New York City. We have to have one. I said, and I just cold called, and Andrew Farkas. There was a commercial company, it's around still, Insignia, and Andrew Farkas ran that company, and he had bought Douglas Elliman thinking, gee, you know, I'll buy this residential company and then I will convert, they'll have customers and people that need commercial stuff, and I'll even grow Insignia more.
Wow.
So I called him and I said, would you sell your company? That was it. And he said, $60 million, I will. That was it. And then I said to him, well, can I meet you? And he said to me, I'll never forget it. He said to me, I promise you, I'm I didn't know that Corcoran was already looking to buy. They were trying to do something with Douglas Elliman. He said, I promise I won't take any other bids and I won't bid you up. So I went and met him and he gave me his word. Then I told Howard. Howard laughed in my face. He said, oh, what is he? You're just a blonde and that's all he's saying because he doesn't, you know, just because you're good looking and you're... Well, he did keep his word. And then he even offered me when I bought the company and I had to walk into all these people like, who are you? He said, do you want me to come around and help you? And I said, no, but thank you. And of course, he checked in on me every once in a while. So, yeah, he did keep his word. But that's really was a cold call.
That was
a highlight, and that was a turning point of my career because, Fran, I don't care what anyone's going to tell you. Real estate is hard no matter where you go. It's not an easy profession, and I think a lot of people don't understand that. However, New York, there's nothing like New York, and it's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the board packages, I mean, nowhere, you know, it's just complicated. But I think that if you make it in New York, like is that Sinatra or whoever sings that song?
You can make it anywhere.
Yeah.
What is your favorite part about your job today?
Well, I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago because I have more time than I've had. And I working 24/7 was my life, you know, and then I had a family, you know, my daughter was still young. But today I think that I have a balance. I'm not trying to plan a balance because that's not how I operate. I do what I have to do when I have to do it. But I think I have a little bit more of a balance. I have a little bit more free time. I have more time for my girlfriends. And I still keep myself busy. I talk and I do speak a lot. I spoke before the pandemic, then the pandemic shut down all that. But now I do speak a lot. I did maybe Fox, a couple of TV things in the last couple of weeks. I stay on my career and I take consulting jobs, for companies that are looking to like grow a different department or maybe open a mortgage department or things like that.
Wow. Okay. Hold on one second.
We never lost the local here.
Okay. Final last question. I'll just wait till he steps out. Sorry. Thanks, Hugh. You rock.
Is it the $1 million question?
It's part one and part two. Dottie, when you're not working, we'll try that one again. Teddy, you'll have to edit that one too. When you're not working, what are some things you do to unwind and stay sane?
Well, you know, I'm a big spin person. I love to spin. I work out. I work out. And I love music.
You look so good.
I love music. I the first thing I do in any place I go to move, before I buy furniture, before I buy anything, is I put my sound system in because I love music. I love all music and I love hearing it. And so when you come to my house, I don't have it on now because I've told you, you'll always hear music.
Really?
Yeah,
that's amazing. Well, that goes hand in hand with my final question, which is, what's your biggest vice?
My biggest advice?
No, biggest vice, like your thing, your go-to little, you know, is it chocolate? Is it wine? Is it cigars?
Well, it's not chocolate. I was never a big chocolate eater. Oh, I think, you know what? I really, once in a while, you know, just like to have I have a glass of wine, and once in a while I'll have a martini, just hang out with some friends. Don't get me wrong, I love traveling and stuff like that, but I really, at this point in my life, I think there's not a lot of great things about aging, but I think the one good thing is that you know who you are, you know what you like. And you don't have to be something that somebody wants you to be because you're secure in yourself. And I have some great friends. I have a great family. Family's really important to me. I have some great friends. And I'm happy. I mean, what else is there? I mean, I'm in a place where I do have the freedom to choose. But, you know, I'm still a simple person. You know, I mean, you know, I do what I did when I hang out with my friends. I have dinner with them. We do our girl talk. I hang out with some guys. We dance. And hopefully, and also, you know, there's a lot of good deeds we do. But I don't think it's all that complicated. I think though, for me, this is a chapter that I want to make great, and I hopefully will make a difference. I do a lot of. If I tell you how many people call me or text me, I just did a little boy who came on my social media, which a lot of these young girls and kids. They go, how did you do it? They don't necessarily ask me about real estate. How'd you do it? Well, this little kid, he was about 14. He said, listen, he wrote to me and he said, he's in Ohio or something. I started an entrepreneur club and I have 40 people in it. He was like in the sixth grade or fifth grade, whatever. He said, would you be a guest on my show?
Oh, sweet.
And of course I said yes.
Oh.
Okay. And it was so cute. I mean, there's little entrepreneurs out there. So I just think that, you know, that really brings me happiness also.
Yeah.
And I am also a believer that you have to make way for the young generation and, you know, help them along. So I really do a lot of giving back and helping people who say, well, how'd you do it? Can I do it? Because, you know, every time you have a bump, you need somebody that you could go to sometimes.
100%. Paying it forward. I have to say, your humility, your genuine way of being, your leadership, your courage, your humanity inspires me and so many people, and I'm very touched. Thank you,
Brenda,
for being
don't
here today.
Cry.
You make me cry.
It was a pleasure. I would start crying. I love you. I was
it's
so
mutual.
Thrilled to, and I promise you, as soon as we'll have dinner next week or two.
I would love that.
Okay, I love you, Fran. And
love
thank
you, too.
You. This was just great. It choked me up a little because it really, I guess I have to think about a lot of things, but thank you. I love you.
Thank you. Love you. Love you more.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.